Trust me.
Dude, you trust me?
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied.
If you think that one person has all the answers, don't!
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and the abuse of power from two firecrackers who've actually experienced it. I am Lola Blanc.
And I am Megan Elizabeth.
And today is part two of our interview with Diane Lake and Deborah Herman. Diane, if you did not listen last week, was the youngest member of the Manson family, known in the family as Snake. And Deborah is the co-author of Diane's memoir, which is called Member of the Family, My Story of Charles Manson, Life Inside His Cult, and the Darkness That Ended the 60s. So in this episode, we're going to discuss the LSD-fueled lifestyle they were living, how Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys was involved with the group, and how Charlie's rhetoric began getting more and more fixated on the idea of a race war as he just basically spiraled downward all while they were all on a lot of drugs.
We also get into how she learned about the murders from the killers themselves, getting out of the group, testifying against them in court, and how being institutionalized after was the best thing that could have ever happened to her.
So, last week, I actually thought that we didn't need to do an explanation of the Manson family and the murders they committed because it's such common knowledge. And once upon a time in Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino's last movie was literally just rewriting the story of the Manson murders. That's how big of an event this was. But then the other night, I was hanging out with a couple of gals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like 1 year above the Gen Z mark.
Okay.
They're younger than me. And they did not know this story somehow. One friend asked, bless her heart, she asked how many Manson girls survived.
Oh.
Which
opposite.
I was like, no, how many? No, they killed. They were other people
right.
are who you should be concerned for in this scenario. Anyway, that led me to the realization that we absolutely need to be giving an overview for you young folk out there who do not know this story. So warning, it is graphic, pretty horrible murder talk. So if murder is not your bag today, then I would say maybe go ahead and skip this one. So here we go. August 8th, 1969, Beverly Hills. Now, Sharon Tate was an actress who was married to the director Roman Polanski, who became infamous for things later on. But this is before that. Sharon Tate, 8.5 months pregnant, living in this house. And basically, she and her three friends who were there that night and then another guy who also happened to be on the property that night were all very violently murdered. There was hairstylist Jay Sebring, aspiring screenwriter Wojciech Frykowski, I think you say. That's how you say it. And his girlfriend, Abigail Folger, who was heiress to the Folger's coffee fortune. And then there was an 18-year-old guy named Stephen Parent who was visiting the guest house. They were all killed violently.
Beyond violently.
Yeah, like horrifyingly violently. The intruders were three women and one man. And here's sort of how it went down. So they showed up, cut the phone lines. Stephen Parent was walking out, I guess, when they got there. So they shot him right away. Mm. And then they went inside, forced everyone in the house into the living room and began committing these like gruesome, horrific crimes. So Sebring was stabbed 7 times. Frykowski was stabbed and then shot twice and then finished off with more stabs as he tried to escape while he was wounded. So he was in total stabbed 51 times. Abigail Folger was stabbed 28 times as she tried to escape. And then in the house, Sharon Tate like begged to be allowed to live long enough to give birth to her child, but they showed no mercy, and they stabbed her 16 times, killing both her and the baby. And then they wrote the word pig on the front door in her blood. The batshit goal of theirs was to make the murders look like they had been committed by Black people to help jumpstart this race war that they thought was imminently coming. The culprits were Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, who was known in the group as Sadie, Linda Kasabian, and Patricia Krenwinkle, and they were all followers of Charles Manson. So Manson had ordered them to go to this house. I think he'd been there before. This like music producer had lived there once or something. He said to totally destroy everyone in it and to be as gruesome as you can. And he told the women to do just what Tex Watson instructed them to do. So then the next night, basically, Manson then took all of them plus two other members, Leslie Van Houten and Steve Clem Grogan, for a drive, and apparently was like not pleased with how the victims had tried to escape and panic the night before. So he brought them to another house to apparently show them how to do it.
Oh,
they stopped at a house in Los Feliz. And I've been to this house because every true crime person has been to this house. I mean, outside. I'm not going to disturb the occupants. But they stopped at this house in Los Feliz where a couple, and I think they're an older couple, a supermarket exec.
Yeah, they were older.
Yeah, and co-owner of a dress shop. They lived, and it was next to a house where they had been to a party the previous year. So it's kind of complicated what happened, but basically Manson went inside and bound up Leno LaBianca and then sent in three of the people. And then the women like started to attack Rosemary, and Watson helped them stab her. And then he stabbed the guy 12 times and carved the word war into his abdomen. And then he went back to where the women were and found Krenwinkle stabbing her. And then Van Houten was told to also join in the stabbings, which she did 16 times. She says that Rosemary was already dead when she participated. And in fact, many of the 41 stab wounds were actually indeed inflicted postmortem. She's been up for parole three times and she keeps getting refused because of the nature of the crime, even though she's been recommended three times and she's in her 70s. But that's a story for another day. Mm-hmm. That's one to debate another time. There was another murder a couple weeks later of a stuntman. That's probably where Tarantino got the premise of his movie. Stuntmen. I don't know. Anyway, all of the killers were in Charles Manson's cults. And we think of him as a serial killer, kind of, but he actually got his heavily indoctrinated and very drugged up followers to commit murders for him. And it was a huge moment in history. So that's the gist. So if you're young and you didn't know, now you know. Mm. So having said that, Megan.
Yes.
Tell me what the cultiest thing that happened to you this week was.
Okay, well, essentially, I was on a little road trip and I went to a Hilton and I almost got sucked into going to one of those timeshare meetings.
Okay, I've been to those actually and I got a free trip out of it. I've gotten two free trips out of it.
I mean, then now I'm thinking I should have gone.
I'm like advocating for you to join the timeshare.
Yeah.
Money cult.
I narrowly escaped and I'm glad because it's just so awkward to have those conversations with people. So I'm here. I'm okay. I am not in a timeshare. like binding contract.
That's good.
Yeah.
I have done a couple of the presentations and I'm telling you, I got, okay, but here's the thing. You get a free vacation out of it, but you get it to like their absolute worst locations.
Right.
So I got a 5-day vacation, but it was in Mesquite, Nevada.
I'm sorry.
In like the hottest place of all time where there is absolutely nothing to do except I think there's like one casino. So I stayed in Mesquite, Nevada for a week with my friends to shoot something nearby in Utah. But
oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's so smart.
I know. That was like my trick. I did it one more time, too. And I think I actually did get a timeshare in Big Bear, maybe. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe that was just my dad's timeshare. I don't think he has the timeshare anymore. My dad got out.
He's free. What about you? What's the cultiest thing that happened to you?
Well, actually, last night I watched a movie that my friend Megan, a different Megan, has been telling me about for a while. And it's from 1995 and it's called Safe. And it's starring Julianne Moore. Do you know this movie?
No.
I had never heard of it. It's beautiful, first of all. It's like lots of pinks and pastels and light turquoises. So pretty. But it is basically, sorry, I'm going to spoil this movie that's like, oh my God, it's 26 years old. What the fuck? Mm. Oh my God, it's as old as my friends who didn't know about the Manson family. But it's about a woman who's a housewife and she's very unhappy in her housewife life. And it starts exhibiting itself in like she starts having physical symptoms basically, and she starts having trouble breathing. She's like feeling like something's wrong. She goes to the doctor. They're like, there's nothing wrong with you. And it is such a well done portrayal of a person who is lost descending into this sort of obsessive paranoia and then finding a group that promises to have the solution. And then that group being the thing that they think is saving them.
Wow.
It is so good. I mean, it gets a little slow in the second half, not going to lie. But I was watching it and I was like, wow, this feels so like ahead of its time because it's really it's talking about chemicals and how there are just chemicals everywhere. And this cult is very focused on chemicals and your chemical sensitivity. And it feels very new agey. It feels very modern and it feels very realistic. Like I have seen it even in myself and in people that I know where we're like not in a good moment in our lives psychologically. So there starts to be some symptom that we fixate on.
Right.
And I could totally see, you know, if I didn't have the mental health support that I have and the friends that I have and like really trying to dive into what's happening with me, I could totally see becoming so fixated that it gets worse and worse. You know, I would be looking to anyone for help.
Yeah.
And that's true of people who actually have real, obviously, that's not only true of people who have psychologically induced symptoms, but people who have actual physical problems as well. I mean, you become desperate and a group is like, we have the answer. We know how to fix you. Come be in our community. And also we'll provide the love that your husband is not giving you in this sad, boring, lonely housewife life that you have. Like, of course that's going to be appealing to you. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm championing this movie. Everybody, I think you should go watch it. I think it's really good.
I'm going to watch it. I'm going to watch it tonight.
Good. I think you should.
I'm going to.
And Julianne Moore is a fantastic actress, which we all knew, but she's just so good in this movie.
Oh my God, I love her so much.
Me too. I had some health problems like at the beginning of last year. And in retrospect, I was like testing negative for what it was that I was convinced that I have, that doctors assumed that it was based on my description of the symptoms, etc. But I just kept testing negative. And in retrospect, I really do think that part of it was this thing that was going on for me emotionally in the relationship that I was in, and I won't get into details about it, but I do think it might have been partially psychosomatic. And we know by now from what we've talked about placebos and also nocebos, which are the negative side effects of placebos, that the symptoms can be really real. Like they physically manifest in a way that's legitimate.
It's wild how real they are.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm like, was that in my head or was it not? I don't know. Am I rambling right now? Yes.
No.
That's okay.
Have you ever done somatic therapy?
No. What's that?
It's kind of where you get into your body and talk to that kind of psychosomatic stuff.
Wait. Have you done it?
No. I actually just got sent a therapist, though, that I was going to maybe contact. I'll send her your information as well. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's actually interesting because I've been thinking about placebo stuff a lot lately and like how much just our state of mind about a particular thing can impact the way that it affects us. And the thought I keep going back to is like, but even if we know that it's induced by our minds, what do we do about it?
Yeah, what's the difference? It doesn't stop.
Right. Right. Like if you're going to therapy and like I have friends who are like, yeah, I'm going to therapy. I'm on antidepressants. Like what else do you want me to do if these symptoms are psychosomatic? Like there's nothing else. So I'm like, there has to be some kind of like concrete thing that you do. And all I can ever think of is affirmations, but I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Well, I'll Google that later.
Yeah, do it.
All right. Well, that was the word vomit of the day. And now we should talk to Diane and Deborah. So let's do it. Woo! Let's play them saying their own names again real quick so we can identify whose voice is whose.
Hello, I'm Diane Lake.
And I'm Deborah Herman.
Thank you. And here we go.
Looking for a killer entertainment deal? What's better than free TV? Pluto TV is the home for true crime lovers. Watch 24/7 channels of unsolved mysteries, cold case files, forensic files, and CSI. Plus thousands of criminally good movies, TV shows, and documentaries all for free. No signups, no fees, no contracts ever. Download the free Pluto TV app on any device.
Can you tell us about Dennis Wilson from the Beach Boys?
He was kind of a wild man, but he and Charlie really liked each other. That was my impression. Dennis welcomed Charlie and us into his house. We didn't just take over his house from my point of view, because I did live there.
You lived at Dennis's house.
I was one of the girls that lived at Dennis's, and he sent a bunch of the other girls to Mendocino to try to find some other place for us to live. Mm. And so Charlie was teaching Dennis how to play the guitar because Dennis was the drummer.
Oh.
And the Beach Boys were kind of on the wane. They were out there looking for talent. You know, the Beatles were big then. The Beach Boys, I think, had taken on, you know, some aspects of the Beatles music, and they, I think that the Beach Boys had gone with the Maharishi.
Oh yeah.
Yogi, the same guy that the Beatles had meditated with or you know, did the transcendence meditation with. And Dennis was going through a divorce or certainly a separation. And I think he had a child. He was kind of looking for a guru. And I don't think the Maharishi met his, probably the Maharishi was a little bit too strict. And Charlie was like, woohoo, you know, let's take LSD, let's do drugs. Sex,
and have group
roll,
sex. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And that was more Dennis's style of guru. So Dennis was kind of a wild man, but he was, you know what? Charlie wanted me to make Dennis happy because Dennis was having a hard time. And, you know, I presented myself, but he wasn't interested. And I think it's because I was underage and Dennis was, he was brought up that this was not okay.
I mean, that's like the first story in your book of a grown man not trying to sleep with this young girl. So, I mean, I was like, oh, finally someone is not like
being
a predator. Yeah. What would you say? Because I was trying to figure out where exactly the downward spiral of Charlie's state of mind began. Like, was it because of sort of the music stuff, or like, where do you think it really began?
You know, I think that there was a turning point that we've kind of pinpointed because we came to the conclusion that he was becoming progressively paranoid, psychotic, maybe even schizophrenic. I don't know. I'm not obviously a doctor or a psychologist, but there was some turning point which was more obvious when the White Album came out.
Right.
Because one of the symptoms of that kind of delusional thinking is hearing something or seeing something and taking personal meaning as if it were a message specifically for you. And that's very common with psychosis. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say that there are theories that he was manipulating everyone during that time at what they called the Yellow Submarine House when Diane was there. But from hearing Diane's version of it and the way he behaved, it really is convincing that he was believing it.
Right.
And
right.
Internalizing it and not just using it as a manipulation ploy.
Right.
Right. And he, you know, we got introduced to Death Valley and then he'd heard stories about the bottomless pit. And then this race war is coming. And then the Beatles are talking to him. He listened to that record backwards and forwards and thought that they were, you know, confirming or affirming his what he already was thinking.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he interpreted the songs to be, you know, that affirmation and confirmation that.
Wow.
Right.
That was what was going to happen. And so then the frenetic energy started, you know, dune buggies and guns and knives. It was really preparing for this race war, mm-hmm. and for us to escape to Death Valley and, you know, find this bottomless pit. I think that kind of got added on later on. And there are people, even now, I think there are people who believe that, you know, under the polar ice caps or whatever, there's caverns where people, you know, can live or do live. I don't know. I mean, I've just, you know, it's a crazy world and there's lots people believe all kinds of crazy things. And so, you know, that's what he had us looking for. We were, you know, when we were out in the desert, even after the murders, we were out there looking for the bottomless pit.
Oh, I didn't know that. Or I'm somehow missed that. You guys were.
They really, really were.
So to clarify what the bottomless pit is, basically there was a passage in the Bible that made them believe there was a society of chosen people living in the center of the earth where they would hide out as the race war raged up above. Leslie Van Houten did an interview in 1969 and some of her quotes were, And so we read, and it talked about a hole in the desert or going to the kingdom. We started looking into the Death Valley, was underneath Death Valley, and we found out there was the Amargosa River and Blindfish and all kinds of things that just made us believe that there was a whole world underneath and that some of Montezuma's people are already under there waiting for us. And that what would happen is that about a couple thousand of the chosen people, white people, would go down to the center of the earth and stay there for about 50 years. So that's what they were looking for, was this bottomless pit.
That's when we, you know, when the guys burnt the road grader.
A road grader? Because I didn't know what a road grader is basically one of those big yellow construction equipment trucks that uses a long blade to create a flat surface on the earth.
Because we had gone over, you know, this mountain or whatever and looking for the bottomless pit, following these, we'd go to all these different springs.
Wow.
That are out in the desert. And then when we came back, we couldn't go over the same way we came because there were all these rocks in the road. And so the guys were able to clear them out and we had like four-wheel drive. So anyway, we got out and then, oh, here's this road grader. And so that was the culprit, you know, that was, you know, had messed up the road. And so the, you know, the guys decided to burn it. Well, the only thing that would burn were the tires.
Right.
You know, and they used our precious gas,
right,
out of the tanks to pour over the tires.
Simply left a matchbook.
Yeah, but that was it was a matchbook. I think it was a Ralph's orange matchbook that was the tie-in that they found. You know, that they found at Barker Ranch.
Right.
It was like, oh, these are the guys. But I mean, that was after the fact because they were, you know, arresting us for, what was it? Grand larceny, I think, or, you know, but it was because they had heard rumors about this family living, you know, this group of people living up in the desert. And somebody was responsible for burning this road grader.
So in essence, the members of the Manson family were not initially arrested for the murders at all. They were arrested for this much smaller crime of burning the road grader. For anyone who's not super familiar with the Manson family, they might think, well, he just told them to commit the murders. He didn't commit the murders. I mean, I think everyone thinks he's a monster. But I also want to just touch on the ways that he himself was actually violent. It wasn't just that he was getting other people to do it. He himself was violent. I mean, first of all, he taught you how to kill someone with a knife, right? Like, or just how to do it. Obviously, you didn't do it, but.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
He's like teaching everyone how to kill people. He not only was advocating for violence and ordering killings, but also he himself participated in injuring a couple of the murder victims. He sexually assaulted you in a very, very horrible way. Was he violent with everyone?
You know, I don't know. Just like he was special, he made everybody feel special. He probably was somewhat violent or showed that edge, but it wasn't necessarily public.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Everybody was, from the research, everybody was afraid of him on some level. And even during the trial, some of the support that he got was also out of intimidation. And that's why he had his remaining acolytes helping during the trial. I mean, he was throwing everybody under the bus so that he could possibly not get the death sentence.
There's a quote in the book that really just like paints his evilness for me, or just at least his abusiveness. The first time he hit you, afterward, this is the quote, he said to you, "You needed me to do that, little one. You have never had any man teach you when to speak or when to be quiet. The man is the head of the household, and you have never had a man or a father. You will learn to be a woman." And then he kissed your forehead after he, like, violently struck you. I mean, what an evil, manipulative abuser. I mean.
Right. But makes you feel, made me feel like it was my fault.
Right.
Where have you heard that before? Like in every domestic violence situation?
Oh, exactly. Exactly. It's so classic. Yeah.
I really felt like he did have some control because I never felt like I was beaten in a rage.
Right.
That's almost scarier.
It is scarier.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Because he was in control.
Right.
Yeah. The combining an act of violence with like a sweet little moment after and like twisting it to make you think that you needed it or it's your fault. I mean, it's just so, so obscenely manipulative. It breaks my heart.
Yeah, I know.
All right. So he's starting to get wilder and wilder. He's talking about helter skelter. this race war, he says, is coming. I mean, there's a night where he starts prophesying about the White Album by the Beatles. And it sounded like that was the first time you like realized he was really, really serious, that the race war was like really happening, and you had to go to the bathroom. Can you tell us about that night?
Yeah, well, he had left me in the desert with a few other people, and I was supposed to stay there. And then Bobby Beausoleil came up, and he wanted a couple of girls, or he wanted a girl to go with him to help him panhandle money so he could get back to the ranch, right? But the family wasn't really at the ranch anymore. They were at this Gresham Street, which we called the Yellow Submarine House because it was a yellow, you know, frame two-story house. Mm. And the minute I left Death Valley, I felt like I was a salmon swimming upstream or whatever. I was going against the current. It was like, I just felt like the rocks and the trees were calling out to me, you're not supposed to be doing this, right? Mm. And when I showed up at Gresham Street, Charlie was just furious. You know, what the hell are you doing here? I told you to stay in the desert. Mm. You know, it was like I'd walked into a different group of people. I mean, not only did he not want me, he says, and I'm going to find your parents. You're going back to your parents. Now they're stealing Volkswagens, converting them to dune buggies. The motorcycle gang is heavily involved, you know, knives, guns. Susan Atkins was in the back house with hepatitis. And, you know, we weren't allowed to go see her. And he was listening to the White Album and playing it backwards. And it was just like he wanted me to sit there. And there were other people as well, but he played it backwards, you know, and I had to go to the bathroom. No, you're going to, you know, you just stay put right there. You're going to listen to this, right? Mm. And so I ended up peeing on the rug. Oh. And then I think he was mad about that. And he ended up, that was the most outrageous, you know, the most enrage I had ever seen him. But like he broke a chair and then he hit me with the chair leg, with the broken chair leg. And there were other experiences where he would hold my finger over a candle flame because we weren't supposed to feel pain. You know, that was just a, you know, a mind thing that we could turn off. Mm. And he did go find my parents and he did take me back there. But then they were being boarding parents of an alternative high school. And so they had a house full of kids my same age, basically.
Oh.
With rich alternative kind of parents.
Mm.
And I just felt, you know, I'd been with Charlie and had been brainwashed enough because I'd been in the desert. I mean, we were in full swing and I just felt like a crazy person and I just didn't fit. And my mom's with another, and my dad's there too, but she's living with another man.
Oh.
Who became her husband, you know, but at that point they weren't married. But still, it was just like, ah, you know, I felt crazy and I just wanted to like climb on the roof and spew out all Charlie's songs, you know, you live in a garbage dump and get your game on, girl, and all, you know, just whatever songs were in my head, I just wanted to get on the roof and sing them out. And so I ended up getting myself back to Gresham, because it really, it turned out they were just a couple miles apart. And then he took me to Gary Hinman's. He really did not want me there. I was a big liability. So he took me to Gary Hinman's and I stayed with Gary for, you know, a week or something. And then I didn't want to stay there either. And so he took me back to Spawn Ranch, but we really weren't living there, but there was another commune living there. And so I went there. You know, I stayed with them and for a couple of nights or whatever, but it was just, and then I think I ended up taking acid with them and going to see the Barbara Ella movie, which scared the heck out of me. And then they took me to somebody else's house and I was hearing voices, you know, just stay where you are until your father comes to get you.
Mm.
But at that point it was like, well, who is my father? You know, my father Chance. My real father, Father God, or
right.
Charlie. I really didn't know. And I think that they must have gotten a hold of Charlie and then, you know, they took me back. I was always on the outside after that.
Mm. But what was interesting to me is that as we explored her story, there were many times where Diane was really facing her own mortality, whether she was going to die because of an accident or by her own hand. There were times that she just needed to escape. And yet it really is a very spiritual story because she always felt the presence of God. And for some reason, it just never happened. And in a way, she was a witness. Because even though Manson kept trying to get rid of her, she was there to because who would believe this?
Right.
And she was there to see the systematic brainwashing.
Right.
Why, even though people to this day are saying, well, he didn't actually kill someone. Well, first of all, I'm an attorney and I studied the 20,000 pages of that transcript. And that's why we also did the book Inside the Manson Jury with a manuscript from the jury foreman. So that was fascinating. But for him, it wouldn't have happened.
Oh, yeah.
And a typical, whether it's a sociopath or psychopath, again, I'm not a psychologist, but typically they do get other people to get their hands dirty. They're like puppet masters.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they're people love conspiracy theories where they say, well, you know, they say that he shouldn't have been sent to jail and everything else. None of this would have happened except for his manipulation and his vision. Am I correct, Diane?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, he sent them.
Yeah.
He sent them and he primed them.
Yeah.
I mean, because he would send the girls out and Tex and I don't know, Bruce or whoever on these creepy crawly missions.
Oh, yes. Talk about those. Yeah.
They would dress in black and they would go and they would just break into people's homes, sneak around, rearrange the furniture, eat some of the food, leave a window open. You know, I mean, just to
terrifying.
Kind of freak people out is my understanding.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of like a game. Mm. It was a game. But see, he was priming them.
Right.
You know, and I was never invited, thankfully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To go on that.
Right.
I think the second night he told them write something witchy, you know, and he was involved in the Hinman thing. He really cowed Bobby into taking care of the problem.
Mm.
You know? But I think Charlie was the one that cut off his ear just to, you know, in the middle of it all. So it was an escalation, you know, and Charlie thought he had killed that Black Panther or whoever he was, that Bernard Crowe.
Mm.
He thought he'd killed him and he was scared. It turned out he hadn't killed him, but he shot
and
him.
That he wasn't actually a Black Panther.
Oh, okay. But he thought all of those things.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He thought all of those things. So he was, you know, I mean, and like you said, he gave us, all of us girls had buck knives and he showed us how to use it. But when I remember that lesson and I remember thinking, oh, it's another one of those mind games, because you had to be willing to do things in order to not do them.
Mm.
It was really a very manipulative thinking.
Right.
What, you know, like you don't need food. You know, you don't feel pain.
Mm.
If you don't want to be killed, you've got to be willing to kill someone. I mean, just like all these, you know, everything was like a mind manipulation game.
Yeah.
With him. So didn't they show that he had actually, like, to the LaBiancas, he'd gone and tied them up and then told the girls and text to go in there and do whatever. I mean, it was just like, oh, it was horrible.
Mm.
It was horrible. So he was very much involved.
Yeah.
Like Deb said, it would not have happened.
Of course. Yeah.
It would not have happened without Charlie's brainwashing and his manipulation.
Right.
I mean, if I take my mind back to, you know, the early days,
mm-hmm.
I can't think of any of them doing that. But especially Patty. Of all the people, I mean, Susan Atkins was much more worldly.
Well, I think people associate Susan as maybe having walked on the dark side because she was involved with
Anton LaVey.
Yeah, the Satan.
The Church of Satan.
The Church of Satan. Thank you. But again, one does not lead to the other, and wouldn't have meant that she would have done that.
And they don't actually believe in Satan also.
There's no way. There's no way that you could do those murders on a hallucinogenic. Mm. There's no way.
Yeah.
In my experience, taking hallucinogenics, you know, marijuana or LSD, there's no way that you could take a life.
Mm.
I mean, you rescue flies out of the pool, you know, I mean,
right.
Because that's what the whole trip is about. You watch trees grow. I mean, you just see life everywhere. Everything is breathing.
Right.
And there's no way you could take a life on LSD. That, I mean, it's probably happened, but I just can't fathom it.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, from my, and that's all I have to go on is my experience.
He was systematically preparing everybody to cause a lot of harm. And when you talk about like him talking about how you don't need food and you don't really feel pain, like to me, this is someone who's priming you all to disconnect from how you really feel all the time. So if your moral compass is in there, you're being taught over and over and over again while on drugs from this man who you believe has the power to get whatever he wants, not to trust your own body, not to trust what you feel inside of you, and put all of your trust in what he is telling you.
Right.
This is like a systematic, long process. It's not like you join the group and then boom, we're going and going to murder some people the next day. I mean, like, yeah.
No, exactly. And I mean, he isolated us from our parents, you know, he, mm-hmm. For me, I mean, maybe because I was underage, but you know, don't look out the window. You know, if I'm in the car, don't look out the windows. Don't get my picture taken.
Mm.
Even though he tried to get me back to my parents, he didn't really want us to honor our parents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know,
it was like, forget them. I mean, I think even some of the words to the songs were, you know, forget your parents, move on.
Right. It's a closed, I forgot what the term, there's like a cult term. It's like a closed system or something like that. Where,
sounds about right.
Yeah. All the information comes from within. There's no.
Yeah, that's what it's called.
Alternative sources allowed.
Recirculating the same water.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you talk to us about when you first learned that they had committed these horrific murders?
I actually was at Spawn Ranch. Leslie had come in, woke me up because she was burning stuff in the fireplace. Smelled horrible. Mm. And then a car came down the driveway and she put it out and said, don't let those guys see me or know that I'm here. And they were looking for her. She told me that they had just given her a ride from Griffith Park, right? So I think it was either that afternoon or the next day that I got whisked off to Olancha, and Tex was there at Olancha, and I was supposed to wait there with Tex, and there was another kid until the rest of the family joined us, and then from there we would all head up to Death Valley. And it really took a group to get up to Death Valley because we had to move rocks and, you know, to get the vehicles up this Goler Wash, which was, well, Deb can tell you, Jeff drove it, and it's very remote.
Yes, he did not want them found.
And so we were there a couple of days, and I think the second day I went looking for food in the dumpster of the little mini mart that was on 395, and I got picked up by the sheriff, you know, for being transient or a runaway or whatever, because I didn't have any ID. And, you know, he didn't think I looked 21. So they took me to Independence, to the jail. And I had been arrested in Ventura County with a fake ID. And so, you know, this is back before digital and Wi-Fi and computers and stuff. So they just called Ventura County and they confirmed it. Yes, they had arrested a Diane Bluestein, you know, age, blah, 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 birthday.
Your fake name. Yeah.
So they let me go. Yeah, my fake name. And so they let me go, and the arresting officer actually took me to his home because I had a really bad sunburn, took me to his home. I, you know, showered. I slept on their couch. They dressed my sunburn, gave me clothes and a hat, you know, and money. And he took me back to where he picked me up.
Mm.
So I went from there. I went back to the little ranch that we were staying at. And there's Tex, just frantic, where, you know, where have you been? And he's got a newspaper, headlines, you know, Tate LaBianca, whatever it said, you know, was big headlines about these unsolved murders. And he slapped the paper and he said, I did this. Charlie told me to. And that's when I found out. So it was like, what? You know, and now I'm really scared. And to think I'd just been in custody.
Yeah.
If I'd known before that, you know, I wouldn't have come back.
Right.
I wouldn't have.
Right.
I wouldn't have.
But now you're with him. So what's going through your mind? What did that feel like?
I was shocked. I was shocked. Like the rug had been pulled out from under me. I mean, my relationship with Charlie and the family had been a little tenuous over the last few months anyway. Mm-hmm. But this was like the last, I just really could not wrap my head around that they really did this. Really? Patty, you know, Susan, I couldn't believe it, but I was scared. It's like, gosh, if he could do that, I better do what he says. And so then the rest of the family came and we all went up to the desert and then, you know, there was really no escaping once I got up there.
No.
Although two of the girls did escape. Two girls did take off and they did make it.
Oh.
But they were together. But Charlie had us beating the bushes for these girls in the night. And I felt in my heart that if we had found them, that they would have been killed. I really did. And then it was like, I don't know, at some point up in the desert, you know, within a couple of weeks, we took acid and we were on the run. You know, we were not at Barker Ranch. We were, you know, every night we'd go off, you know, at night we'd be at the Barker Ranch and then during the day we'd be off somewhere else. But there was this place, I think it was Willow Springs, that the girls told me, Leslie, Susan, and Patty.
Whoa.
They told me personally their participation. And what stuck with me was their demeanor.
Like proud?
Proud, gleeful. It was gleeful. They were giddy. They were giddy about it. You know, it was like, ooh, we did this for Charlie. You know, I was like, ooh, helter skelter. I was like, oh, it was sickening. It was horrible.
Yeah.
It really was. And it was scary. And I mean, these are gals that I made love with,
yeah.
You know, that I'd had,
right.
You know, participated in sex with. And it's just like, and they were my, you know, they were my friends and my sisters, really.
Yeah.
You know, even though, I wasn't maybe best friends with them, but they were still part of the family, you know, and I couldn't believe it.
I think I remember reading that one of them said that she was debating whether or not to kill Sharon Tate's baby.
No, that was Susan Atkins. She was contemplating saving the baby, cutting the baby out and rescuing it.
And what stopped her?
Probably Tex. I don't remember because I think it was just probably super frantic and
yeah.
Tex was kind of in charge. And I'm sure he just told her to do something else or what, you know,
right.
Just get it done or whatever. But she told me Sharon was begging to spare her baby's life.
Oh no.
Just the story is so sad.
I mean,
on so many different levels, sad, terrifying, diabolical, there's so much wrong. I mean, it's so wrong. It's all so wrong. And then the reasons that it was done is even, it's craziness is really what it is. It's just like, ooh, off the chart. Like
yeah.
They went off the deep end, off the deep end. But it was all because of Charlie's beliefs.
Ooh.
And they've had to live with that their whole life.
Did they change kind of how they felt about what had happened?
I think at some point, you know, in their life. Yeah, no, I think they have definitely have misgivings and
right.
Remorse. You know, whether or not the parole board, they can get that across sufficiently, you know, to have been released.
Right.
Or not, that's another, but I feel like in my heart for sure, they have to. Once they came down off of that manipulation mind control of Charlie's, Oh, I mean, and so they've had to live with that for, you know, over 50 years? Mm. I mean, a long time.
Deprogramming, or, you know, sort of waking up from indoctrination, is always an intense, earth-shattering, insanely difficult process. But I cannot fathom adding murder into that. Like, mm-mm. How can you even face that? You did that for
right.
your cult leader. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Right. I know.
Can you tell us about your journey afterward and how you sort of began to wake up?
Well, while I was in the jail at Inyo County, all the girls were in one cell together.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys were in another cell together.
So you'd gotten arrested for something unrelated, right? Just for context for everyone.
Right. I had been arrested along with the rest of the family for grand larceny, for burning this road grader.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The girls all, were admonishing me or threatening me or whatever. Don't say anything about anything. And, so I didn't even tell them how old I was or my real name or anything. Mm. And we were arrested in October. And it wasn't until, Susan had, anyway, so good food, although we were all throwing up a lot of our food because we didn't want to get fat in there,
mm.
because we were eating a lot more food than we're ever used to.
Wow.
So good food, no drugs, reading, because not a lot to do. We played gin rummy and other card games, and I started reading. And then I remember overhearing a couple of the matrons say something, they were talking to each other and they were, like, oh, those poor girls, they're never going to amount to anything, or they're never going to come back from this, or whatever they said,
mm-hmm.
made me like, what? Perk up, look around. And it was like, oh my gosh, I got to get out of here. I don't want to. What?
Yeah.
It's just like I woke up, I took stock of my situation and I didn't like it. And it was shortly after that when Susan had started blabbing in LA that they did a grand jury indictment and they sent all of us girls up to LA. And it wasn't until I stood in front of the bailiff about ready to go in to testify in front of the grand jury when they, perfunctorily said, what name, age, all that, birth date.
Mm.
And I told them the truth. I said, I'm Diane Lake.
Ah.
I'm 16 and I want my mommy. And I did. It was just like, and that was the first time that I had felt safe enough to tell them that, right? Safe enough and sane enough. Because the other girls weren't around,
mm-hmm.
Because we were one at a time to go in there. And then I went in and lied, it was just like, come on, I just, one little crack, and then whoop, then the fears, the fears from the girls, I'm going to go anyway. So I'm 16 in a women's jail, right?
Mm.
So they quickly isolated me. And then when we went back to Inyo County, I had every cold case attorney, detective in California and beyond interviewing me.
Mm.
And I'd been through a bad interview at whatever the name of the, the women's jail is in Los Angeles. I mean, they threatened the gas chamber and that they knew I was involved. And, they interrogated me for hours.
Mm.
And it was really scary. And so, I just wanted to tell the truth. It was probably in December. Well, it was in December that we went to the grand jury. But then when I came back, they quickly made me a ward of the court and sent me to Patton State Hospital for a psychiatric evaluation for 90 days, which then turned into like 8 months.
Oh, wow.
And I think and it's because they didn't know what to do with me. They didn't want me to go back to my parents. And I quickly came into myself. I mean, I wasn't hearing voices anymore. And, I stopped throwing up my food, mostly because I saw another gal in there who was bulimic or anorexic. And she was just a bag of bones.
Mm.
I mean, literally. And that's why she was there.
Mm-hmm.
She was there because she had a really severe eating disorder. And so I was like, all right, I'm not doing this anymore. Mm-hmm. And then my arresting officer from Death Valley, he saw something worth saving in me, and he took me in as a foster child.
Oh.
So I went back to Inyo County, and I lived there for the, you know, until I turned 18.
Oh, wow.
I'd had my 17th birthday in the hospital. And I had all these moms, you know, the nurses. I had a psychiatrist, a psychologist. I had friends. I had gals that I met, you know, on the receiving ward. They kept me on the receiving ward. They didn't transfer me to, you know, the drug ward or the teen ward. They had all these different wards. So the receiving ward would kind of evaluate you, and then they'd farm you out to the different, you know, more specialized units. They didn't farm me out to those. So I stayed there for the whole 8 months with the same nurses and doctors. And it was really a very nurturing time. I mean, I think mental health was being administered appropriately back then. Mm-hmm. That was back in the, you know, the late 60s.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah. I learned how to play the flute there.
Mm. Wow. You know?
And I learned how to crochet, and I went to church. You know, I remember it being a good experience. And
wow.
I learned a lot about, I had a friend who came in several times in the course of the months that I was there as an alcoholic. So I saw what happens to, you know, you drink too much.
Right.
You get addicted to that, you know, and the bulimia. And so it was a good, you know, it was a good experience. And then, you know, like I said, my arresting officer took me into his home and helped me get through the trial. It was good.
There was another advantage that was coincidental. The head of the unit, the program at Patton State at the time, was someone who was specializing in this newly developed problem of LSD use among young people. And so he was very focused on helping her to heal and to regain, you know, her personality and her inner self.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very fortunate that she wound up there.
Yeah.
Very progressive program.
Thank God.
I feel very fortunate that they sent me there. And even though, you know, I was embarrassed for, along with being part of the Manson family, embarrassed to tell anybody that I had been in a mental institution. But it was a good experience, you know. And
that's amazing.
My parents, you know, my parents weren't together anymore. And, you know, my mom had, you know, a new baby, you know, with her husband, her new husband. And, you know, my dad was off, I don't know, baking in New York or something. I mean, he became a baker. Then he became a cabinet maker, but
not that he was baked.
Right.
He really became a baker. But anyway, I mean, so it was like, you know, I really didn't have any roots.
Right.
And the Manson family was looking for me, because even when I got out.
You had a lot of protection. I've actually been reading some of the hospital records, and they did not want her parents to visit with her.
Really?
For her. Yeah. Do you remember that, Diane? They didn't want you to go home with your parents.
Oh, no, they didn't want me to go home there. Yeah. And they did come and visit a couple of times, but, you know, maybe that was discouraged and I didn't know it. They might have discouraged them, but I think that it, you know, my family, my mom and, you know, her husband, they're still hippies.
Right.
You know, they didn't really have the resources or the fortitude, or, you know, they couldn't provide me with the kind of home that they would have maybe released me to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, it was probably a good move.
So how long after this initial arrest did the trial happen?
It was probably a year later.
Okay, so you were already out of the institution at that point?
Oh, well, when we were arrested in October.
Okay.
And then I probably went into the hospital. The grand jury happened in December.
Mm-hmm.
After that October, I was probably put in the hospital in January, and I got out like end of August. So I, in time to go to school, start school in Inyo County in September. And then it was the following, I think, January or December. So I was 17.
You were actually the last witness, with the exception of your doctors who would validate that you were capable of being a witness.
Testifying, yeah.
Thursday, November 5th, you were witness number 81 on the list, Miss Diane Elizabeth Lake, age 17, alias Diane Bluestein, sometimes called Snake by the family members. You joined the group at the age of 14. The witness told of the conversation with Leslie Van Houten at Willow Springs in Death Valley when they were both family members. Miss Van Houten told Diane that she had stabbed someone who was already dead, that she didn't want to do it, but she did it anyway. She said that Van Houten told her that she wiped fingerprints around the rooms of the La Bianca home on the night of the murders.
Mm.
So that's direct quote from her testimony and notes taken by the jury foreman.
Wow.
That is inside the Manson jury. And also what's interesting that people don't realize is Diane was brought in to talk with an attorney before she was going to testify and was warned that she could be charged with being an accessory and also charged with perjury. And she made the decision at age 17 that she was going to testify because it was more important to her to tell the truth.
Aww.
So she's my hero.
Yeah, same.
That is amazing.
Well, I just believe that the truth would prevail.
Yeah. Were you afraid to testify?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely was. And I was afraid. I didn't want to be charged with perjury.
Yeah.
But I was mostly afraid that I was going to have to face Charlie.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't hearing his voice anymore. And I was afraid that I was going to hear his voice and that he was going to, tell me to, say something that wasn't the truth. But I went in there and one of the first questions was, did you love Charlie? And it was like, yeah, I did. I guess so. And Charlie just jumps up and says, don't put it all on Mr. Manson. She loved everybody.
Oh, wow.
So that made me, and I didn't hear his voice. I mean, I heard his real voice.
But right.
I didn't hear like some funny business going on in my brain.
Mm.
It just made me see him for the clown.
Right.
That he was, the actor or the court jester.
And that he didn't really care about anyone but himself.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He didn't even want to hear that I loved him. That meant nothing.
Right.
Yeah, he was totally disconnecting himself from the family at that point.
Right. Oh, yeah. He just sounds just completely
insane.
The rails. There's no words. There's absolutely
insane.
No words.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've met a few younger people who were maybe 10, on their paper routes. And Charlie was the boogeyman. Charlie was the guy behind them when they were picking up their newspapers and delivering them in the pre-dawn or dawn.
Mm-hmm.
It was Charlie. Yeah, no, Charlie had put the fear of God in a lot of people,
the whole country. I mean,
it was a major shift in our society. That's why people are still talking about it today,
mesmerized. Mm-hmm.
And analyzing it and reading about it, because there's a very significant turning point. Just like we can say, what was the world like before 9/11?
Or before 2020.
Exactly.
Yeah,
or before the Capitol riots now. I mean, it's just like, woo!
Mm-hmm.
So there are those times in our mutual experience that shift our thinking and our way of life.
People think of it as sort of the end of the innocent era of the 60s, kind of. Is that sort of what it was?
I think it sure put the brakes on the hippie alternative lifestyle being as innocent as it really was to a great extent.
Or as I should say, like optimistic or
denial of consequences.
Right.
Yes, of course, some of it was beautifully innocent. And I always consider Diane a true flower child in a garden of major weeds. But there were things that were moving in a direction of, let's just say, debauchery.
Right.
Right. But that's always existed. I mean, as now, the Me Too movement has exposed, and it keeps exposing, how much pedophilia and sex trafficking It's rampant, you know, and I think it always has been. It's just with the media and more women coming forth and saying enough is enough. You know?
I'd like to unknow some of this stuff.
Yeah. How long was the process of like actually really fully being out of it and like no longer believing? Like, was it really that fast that it happened within those 2 months? Or like, how long did it take mentally, emotionally?
Yeah, no, it was probably about a year, because even then, when I started going to college, I was naive. I didn't even really know until we started writing this book that the family, they were still together at the Spahn Ranch. I didn't know that. I mean, I just assumed people got arrested, they were convicted of these murders, and that, you know, that was the end of it.
Yeah, you'd think murder would be a solid line in the sand, but no. Yeah.
No. And so I didn't even, you know, I didn't fear for my life until I was staying at a friend's house while I was going to college. And, you know, some scrappy looking guys came to the door and were looking for me.
Mm.
And my now husband was the one that answered the door, because he was a friend of my friend Mary. And they were looking for Diane Lake or Snake. And so he like shooed me so they wouldn't see me. And then he told them to get out of there. And then he said, you know, you're hot. You're wanted. You're being sought after. You need to get out of town.
Mm.
And so he invited me to come and live with him in Spokane, you know, when school was out, which I did. And then we decided to go to Europe. And so we ended up being in Europe for 2 years.
Mm.
But that was all a good thing and a God thing, I think, because it totally removed me from even thinking about it. And I wrote my mom these huge, long 10, 20 page letters from Europe, and she saved them. And I've read most of them now, and I never refer to being in the family.
Mm.
No, I just like, I put it behind me. Was like this skeleton in my closet.
Mm-hmm.
But it really didn't come to the surface until like 2009, when Paul Dosky called me and said, you know, my cadaver dog has alerted to human remains up at Barker Ranch, and I have permission to dig where he alerted. And if we find human remains, you're going to be right back in the middle of it, because
we
feel like you told Jack Gardner, that was my, you know, my foster father, my arresting officer, that there were bodies buried up there. Well, I don't remember there being bodies up there, but there were people that would come and go up there. And so I probably said there could be.
Right.
I don't know. There could be. But that was enough information. And so they did dig and they didn't find bodies. And so it never came out. But that was the instigator for me to tell my children.
Mm.
My husband knew, but I had to tell the kids, because it was like, oh gosh, if they find, you know, if they find human remains and this all gets, you know, dug up again,
right.
You know, I didn't want them to find out that way.
Yeah, of course.
So I told them, but they were, you know, my youngest was probably in high school and he didn't find out until later. But the oldest one was in college. You know, my daughter was living at home, but she was out of high school.
I also think that what you may be asking is emotionally whether there were still emotional repercussions or trauma. And from where I'm sitting as Diane's collaborator, I think going through the process and the journey of writing her book and telling her story, I think there was a lot of buried trauma. And major tentacles that remained that you really worked through, Diane. I mean, now you're successfully married again. You had lost your husband, and now you're remarried. From what I experienced with you, I don't know that you would have really been ready had you not, you know, unpacked and faced what had really happened.
Yeah, no, it was very cathartic. And I give glory to God for preserving me through it all. And, you know, where I pretty much came out with my brain intact, you know, and my psyche intact. And I was healed and I had good experiences from that healing. But then I was ashamed, you know, for many, many years. I didn't unpack it.
Yeah.
You know, I, other than the therapy that I got in the hospital, I did not seek out you know, additional therapy. But I wanted to give glory to God for getting me through this. And once the process, and then, you know, led me to Deb, and we started unpacking it. And like she said, I didn't have any, it was like probably looking in a, like one of those old fashioned viewfinders, you know, one little picture at a time, very dry and very matter of fact, because I had like these little snapshots, and I had gotten a life coach, and she had me writing, you know, my memories. And that's basically all I had when I came to Deb, was a journal of what I considered to be chronological memories of my time through this counterculture alternative lifestyle that led me through the hog farm and to Charlie and then out of it, you know?
Yeah.
So the whole process has been very therapeutic and very cathartic for me to, I still have a little cringe, you know, was that really me? Yes, it was. I can't really be proud of what I went through. But I can be thankful and I can be grateful that I got through it and that God helped me, and that that maybe this story, my story, can help others, you know, and maybe give hope to parents or sisters,
right?
You know, that have friends and family going through similar, because there's still a lot of men and women out there who are manipulating for greed or what, you know, for their own delusionment about what life is.
Right.
And respect for people. And so, but I came out of the other end. There is light at the end of the tunnel. And so I hope that my story brings a little bit of light to this very dark period of our history. And also it provides a little bit of hope for other people who are in a cult or are being even a battered wife, you know,
when
you're trapped, you know, you're like, you're trapped and you really, your whole experience is bound up in these parameters, you know, all these rules, you know, that you can't escape from.
Yeah. Well, I commend you for telling your story. I know that it is, it's so hard to overcome that shame, and especially with such a notorious case like this. I just think it's really amazing and I really respect you. And I think the book is awesome and everyone should go buy it.
It's called Member of the Family. Right now, there is a page for Inside the Manson Jury on Facebook. We're working on a website for Manson Books and for Diane. But right now, that's probably the best place. And of course, both books are available wherever books are sold.
Anywhere you buy your books.
It was truly one of the best writing experiences of my, you know, tenure as an author. And I wish that everyone could write their own memoir, because looking at your life from above it, you know, what I found working with Diane was that we really made a lot of connections of things that you don't realize connect. And it was a shared journey. I learned a lot about myself as well. And of course, we've remained friends. And I'm glad that you liked the book. It was truly a wonderful journey.
Yeah. Well, thank you both so much. This has just been wonderful. Okay. That's the end of that. That was incredible. I'm so glad they came on. How did we get so lucky, Megan? How did we get so lucky?
I have no idea, but it's amazing. That was so interesting.
I know. Well, I don't really have a question to ask you, because I asked you last week and your answer was, yeah, if you were in Diane's position, you probably would have joined the group. And my answer is the same. If anyone's listening to this episode and not last episode, I don't know why you're doing that. You should probably listen to the last episode so you can hear our reasoning for why. I feel like I don't have any brilliant conclusions here. But gosh, that was such a crazy time in American history. I mean, there were murders happening all the time, like serial killers in the 60s and 70s. It seemed like constantly. And this, and then, of course, obviously, there was all the civil unrest for very good reason. I mean, just what a crazy time.
But the music was great.
The music was great. I don't know. There aren't as many, like, serial killery type murders anymore, but gosh, there are sure a lot of shootings, and I would like for that to stop, so I'm just putting that out into the world. I don't know, The world is fucking crazy right now. But hey, we're here together. We have each other. Mm. It's you and me, Megan.
Against the world. Against all, every single cult and bad dynamic in the world.
Yep.
Thank you guys so much for listening. We will see you next week. And remember to follow your gut, watch out for red flags,
and never ever trust me.
Bye.
Save big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now.